Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Gail Seiler, together with Jasmine Merguia. Hello, Jasmine. Thanks for co-hosting with me today.
Hello, Gail.
This is the first time we've been able to co-host, so this is exciting.
Very.
There are several things we could talk about on today's show. For example, today is Friday the 13th. Some people see that as a bad luck day.
Right, but did you know that in Mexico, it's Tuesday the 13th, not Friday the 13th? So that people associate that with bad luck.
I had heard that. I did know that, yeah. So let's take that perspective and say that today is not a bad luck day, but just a regular day.
Cool, I like that. And so because it's Friday the 13th, tomorrow's Valentine's Day, so that's what our theme for the show will be today.
And we have several very interesting segments that are connected to Valentine's Day. In the second half of the show, we're going to hear from Dan Brabeck from Coe's Flowers about what flowers people like to buy for Valentine's Day. And we'll also be talking to Brianna Burke, a professor at ISU. And in that segment, we'll be discussing kind of the hidden costs of Valentine's Day purchases, the environmental and human costs of all the Valentine's Day flowers and candy that people buy.
But first, we're going to be talking about the local production of The Vagina Monologues, a play that has become a Valentine's Day tradition in the United States and across the world. The Vagina Monologues was written in 1996 by activist performer and Tony Award-winning playwright Eve Ensler. Her goal was to give voice to the experiences of women and girls that are often silenced, particularly around the violence that women experience.
The Vagina Monologues is based on a series of interviews that Eve Ensler did with women of various backgrounds and experiences. The stories these women have shared are reproduced in the play each year, usually around Valentine's Day. The play has been performed in over 140 countries, and all the proceeds from this production, from these productions, are donated to local organizations that work to end violence against women.
The local production has been organized by Margaret Sloss Women's Center at Iowa State University. It is a benefit to raise funds for the nonprofit organization, the Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support, also known as ACCESS, which serves Ames and the surrounding communities. There are two remaining performances of the Vagina Monologues tonight, Friday at 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. in the Campanile Room in the Memorial Union on the ISU campus. And we are grateful to have two of the people involved in this year's production here in the studio. With us today are Carolyn Duven, one of the directors of this year's play, and Olivia Gard, an actor in the play. Welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Cool. So let's first talk about the play in general. Can you tell us a little bit more about the origin and the history of the Vagina Monologues?
Eve came from a place that she is a survivor of sexual assault and molestation and just was looking for a way to be able to give voice to that experience and wondered if other people and other women had had that same kind of experience. And that's really why she started the Vagina Monologues, was a healing process for herself, but then she found it to be liberating both for her and for the women that she was interviewing.
Cool. So how many monologues or characters are there in the play or in this year's production?
We have 25 women who are participating, and some of them have more than one role. Eve requires that anybody who auditions is involved in the production in some way. So there are parts for women that feel really comfortable acting or reading scripts in front of folks like Olivia here. Mm-hmm. And then there are smaller parts that are more introductory that do not require people to have a lot of acting experience previously.
And what would you say was then her purpose in bringing the monologues together and making them into a play?
For me, I think it's an accessible art form. It's understood by a lot of people. And it's something that, like a play is a familiar thing. So people would probably not go to like a slam poetry reading of the Vagina Monologues. That wouldn't be nearly as accessible as a play called the Vagina Monologues. She wanted to use it as a tool for people to be able to raise awareness. And it eventually became a way for people to raise funds for organizations in the area. We're performing a benefit production. Eve does not charge us any royalties or any fees to be able to do the production as long as all of our proceeds go to a local organization.
Okay. So it's really fulfilling multiple purposes, fundraising, awareness and education for people who come to see it, but also a very important kind of personal purposes it's fulfilling for the people who participate in it.
Absolutely. One of my cast members wrote in her blurb for our program that it was a liberating experience for her to learn her character and to be involved in this entire process.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope as a director that that's the experience that all of the women have who participate in the Vagina Monologues.
And so why is it done around Valentine's Day? Do you know?
So the way that I understand it and the way that I think and reason why it's done around Valentine's Day, and Olivia, you can let me know if I'm speaking incorrectly, is that it's often associated with love and with happiness in relationships, and what a better way to showcase what might not always be a happy conversation for women than to put it, juxtapose it next to something that's supposed to be so happy.
Mm-hmm.
The V-Day campaign is what Eve calls this entire process, and it stands for Victory, Vaginas, and Valentine's. So it's this whole coming together of all of, you know, Valentine's Day, being proud of who we are as women, but also raising awareness of what reality is for many women around the world.
That's interesting. I didn't know that that's what that the V-Day name stood for those three V words.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that kind of explains why she chose to call it the Vagina Monologues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So can you tell us a little more about what that movement is?
For me, the movement is about empowering women in local organizations to be able to speak and share their experience and then to be able to do something about it. Words are hard early in the morning. Sorry. In the documentary, Until the Violence Stops, or Until the Violence Ends, Eve goes to various parts of the United States and the world and talks about how this production has really changed the perspective of the women in areas where they are the most oppressed. There was a country in Africa, and I don't remember the specific country, and I don't want to misspeak. And then in the Philippines, Eve worked specifically with comfort women from the Second World War, and they talked about how amazing it was to feel like their stories had been valued by somebody and that they were able to really take control of something when they had not had control before.
Mm-hmm. And Olivia, let's bring you in here as well. Was it the history and the story behind the Vagina Monologues that first attracted you to it?
Well, I do think that the history is a big part of the Vagina Monologues. It's a big part of why I'm involved. I also enjoyed getting involved because of the unique opportunity to participate with other women in this performance. And so kind of the attraction for me was the format of a play. I've been involved in other kind of plays and performances before, but this is so unique because it's based on real stories, and it's a way to give voice to those stories of other women.
So maybe we can switch our focus now to your current production at ISU. And Carolyn, just to repeat again, you're one of the directors. There are several. And Olivia, you are one of the actors in the play.
Right.
So, maybe we could talk about just your involvement. If you've been involved in past years, past productions, and, why you want to be involved.
Yeah, well, I have been involved for 2 years now. I'm a senior currently at Iowa State. I enjoyed it last year. It was a really interesting and empowering activity to be involved in. And so, of course, I went out again this year for the Vagina Monologues. I could see myself doing it in the future as well. I know a lot of women have been involved for many years. And my past experience, my character was different from the character that I play this year. So that's kind of a cool opportunity with it as well, is the ability to perform with many different types of people, types of characters that have the different experiences in life.
Take on the different roles and the different monologues.
Right,
yeah. And Carolyn, you've also been involved for multiple years.
I have. As an audience member, as an actress, and then here at Iowa State, being able to be involved as a director. My initial involvement was just because I thought it was cool, and then I continue to be involved because of the message it sends. My mom and my sister are both survivors of sexual assault, and it's really powerful for me to have an organization that is working so hard to create solutions and to prevention and awareness so that my nieces will hopefully never have to be a survivor of sexual assault. Like, that's really what I hope. And I also have just really valued the relationships that I've built with the other directors and the women in the production. It has really made a big difference in my life. And I've been inspired by each of the actresses that we've worked with. And that just keeps me coming back.
Okay, I'll go. Let's just keep asking, talking with you, Carolyn, as a director. Can you tell us a little bit about the process you used in deciding, you know, how to produce the play or how to stage it or, yeah, just what to make it look like this year?
Absolutely. Eve has some really specific requirements for the way that the piece is performed. We acknowledge that the stories that are being told are not the stories of the women who are reading them. So each of our actresses reads them from the script in their hand. And some folks think, oh, you know, they must not have done their work. Actually, we're really honoring the stories of the women that Eve worked with to create the original monologues. Personally, I really like to work with the women to find their own connection and their own way of interacting with that character and of being a part of it. And sure, I have preferences about the way the monologue should be read, but I look at each woman and what they bring uniquely to the reading and really give space to their personalities and their experiences and the ways that they want to approach it. Because I could, you know, be like a really hardcore director, or I could give somebody a lot of space to really explore something.
And do you guys, does the production do any type of workshops with the women to prepare them for these monologues and the stories they're about to, you know, recite?
I've done group meetings with the people that I direct so that we all can come together and see what one another have done. Mostly I do one-on-one direction. Unless it's a group piece, then we talk. One of the pieces I direct this year is They Beat the Girl Out of My Boy, or So They Tried, and there are five women as a part of that. And so we've talked about the ways that they've connected with that piece. And so it's a little bit of a different experience to be able to have five women versus just, you know, working one-on-one with Olivia. That becomes a really personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. And there are how many directors?
There's five of us this
year.
Okay. Yes.
All right. And Olivia, as an actor, what were your thoughts when you were trying to understand your character this year and to be her voice?
Well, my character, while it's not my own story, it is an honor to tell her story in a way that, that is interesting and compelling to the audience.
And can you tell us also the name of your character?
Yeah.
Because it's an interesting name.
Yeah. So the name of my character is The Woman Who Loved to Make Vaginas Happy. So basically her character is a sex worker who only did sex work with women. And so her experience was a positive one. And so my monologue kind of uses the tool of humor and brashness almost to convey her story in a way that's kind of entertaining and compelling and interesting to the audience. So that was unique, and that took a little bravery on my part too, to portray a sex worker in a brash and interesting kind of way. So yeah, that was my experience with my character this year. It took some practice with my individual director, like we were saying, individual meetings every week. But a lot of it was just kind of taking that on myself and saying, okay, I'm ready to do this, and I can do this. So, yeah.
Yeah, I saw the show on Tuesday night, and your character, for people who haven't seen it yet, has some very funny but very touching moans that you do in your monologue.
Yeah.
And it also struck me that yours and many of the monologues have both, like, have a real range of emotions, where there's kinds of some happy moments and some positive things that people have found, but then things about their stories that are completely the opposite and are very devastating and painful.
Yeah, I guess one of the lines from my character is, right at the beginning, she says, "I love vaginas. I love women. I do not see them as separate things." And that's her view, is looking at women in that way. And kind of the other characters, they explore sometimes women's sexuality, their experiences in all their individual facets of their experiences. So, yeah, it's really interesting to see all the different characters and how they come about and how they end up being performed. So.
Cool. So how long does it take for this production to be in play now?
It takes about 3 months. Hmm. So we do auditions in November, and then we have initial meetings with the entire cast to kind of welcome them and to start building that community amongst cast members. And then winter break happens. And then we come back in January, and we have a month to be able to do all of our rehearsals, to do our tech rehearsals so that people feel comfortable talking in microphones. And then our dress rehearsal was just this last Sunday, dress rehearsal hasn't always been my favorite part. But this year, it really was a really pivotal moment for our cast. Mm-hmm. And they did just an amazing job and have continued that through their first performance on Tuesday.
Cool. And you've mentioned you've been involved in previous productions. Was there one production 1 year that maybe just stuck out at the moment with the audience or even with the cast members?
There are individuals who perform the monologues or groups that, when I sit and listen, they're who I imagine when people talk about it. I don't think that there's ever been one cast that I have said is above all others. But individual people have these moments of magic with their pieces that I really, really enjoy.
And you mentioned that Eve Ensler, the playwright, requires that some things be kept the same. And yet I noticed in this year's production there were obviously some references to the local context. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Eve wants the production to be really accessible. And so there are areas that she allows the individual production folks to create and add their own twist on things. Specifically in the introduction, when they are covering all of the different kinds of things that vaginas are called throughout the country, throughout the world, we're allowed to add up to 5 of our own colloquial names for the vagina. A Little Syride in Ames has been a very popular name for vagina since I've been here at Iowa State.
See, I'm new to Iowa. I learned that at the play the other night. There have been some critiques of the vagina monologues, that it presents too narrow a vision of women's experiences. And I know that on the website I was looking at for your show, you addressed some of those. But maybe you could just talk about those and share your thoughts on that.
Well, I've heard that one of the critiques is the vagina monologues uses the vagina as a symbol of empowerment and as a symbol of a recurring theme throughout the monologues, of course. But there are people who identify as women who do not have vaginas. And so that has been a critique. I think that personally, for me, it's important to just kind of think critically in the production, and if there are critiques of it, then that's definitely to be valued. That's my view, is that there are critiques out there, and that all women may not find the vagina mm-hmm. monologues empowering, and just to value kind of those individual experiences and preferences and opinions. I think that's really at the heart of vagina monologues is looking at all those different experiences and opinions and valuing those. And so I think that it makes sense to consider those critiques and to think about that. So,
to be honest, I hadn't ever really had a critical lens of the vagina monologues until this year, mostly because I was very enamored with the idea and have found a lot of empowerment myself within the monologues. So when I heard about the school on the East Coast that wasn't going to perform because it didn't represent a diverse enough group of women, I was really frustrated. But I've taken a lot of time to reflect on it and to really do some deep digging with myself and figure out, I think this critique is okay. And I think Eve works really hard to be representative, but knowing that there are so many voices in this world that it's difficult to be fully representative of all voices. I found myself agreeing with the critique, and so I have this dissonance in my head going on. Like, I really love this production, but I see the value and the experience of these other women that they're not necessarily being involved. One of the other pieces that I've been reflecting on is the really lack of Latino women specifically throughout the production. And, you know, being aware of that is something that we as directors can work to recruit and to really try to find a voice for Latino women throughout the production. But it's my hope that Eve continues to add pieces. Every year there's a new piece that comes out that spotlights her current work around the vagina monologues or a current issue that's going on throughout the world related to vaginas. And it's my hope that she explores and takes some of that criticism and to really use it to fuel some artistic creation and to really make the vagina monologues better.
Sure. Yeah, that's I didn't realize that new pieces are added. So there is that flexibility to be responsive to new awarenesses and new ways of thinking about women's experiences.
And what kind of reactions do you get from the audience each year? Like, is there a different response each night?
Yes.
Yes. Just, it's like any other, you know, performance or public play. It's you get different audiences every night, and they react differently.
Things I think are funny, nobody else finds funny. And I laugh, and I have a loud laugh, so everybody knows I think it's funny.
So is there a difference between, like, Tuesday and Friday night?
The Friday night show, the late night show, tends to be the most loud and raucous show that we have. It's often not the one that we sell out, but the people who come tend to have just a different energy and approach to the show.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll come back for another show tonight. So just to remind our listeners, there's shows at 6 and 9 tonight at Memorial Union.
Okay. So why do you think people do keep going back to watch these monologues each year? Is there the same people going?
I think that there are a lot of people who continue to come back because they have found something in the vagina monologues that they identify with, or they really appreciate who it's raising money for. On Tuesday, I took my staff. I'm a hall director here at Iowa State, and I took my staff, some of whom had seen it before, seen the monologues before, and some of whom hadn't. And the range of learning experiences that I got from their, like, just their reflections that I asked them to write and to share with me, really show why the vagina monologues work so well. From, you know, questioning their own privilege as a woman who hasn't had to really think about issues related to their vaginas versus men on my staff going, I didn't know it was that complicated. I didn't know that that there was so much going on in a woman's experience.
And we just have a minute or two left. We haven't talked much about access. Are there, maybe you want to tell the listener about what Access does.
Access is a pretty amazing place that offers, you know, in the name, it kind of gives it all, extending shelter and support So individuals who find themselves in a situation where they are a survivor of sexual assault can call Access and get a confidential advocate to respond and help them throughout the entire process without pressure, without judgment, and without or with care for who they are. And I think that's a really amazing thing that Access offers to the Ames community. When I think of the statistics related to rape in college-age women, Access really does a great service for all of the students at Iowa State. And in the Department of Residence, we work really closely with Access so that we make sure that the responses that we have to sexual assault are really meeting the needs of the students. So not only do they provide this direct service, but they do education, and they work really strongly with the departments at Iowa State and the police officers throughout Story County. It's a pretty amazing group, and I've worked with some of the advocates and some of the staff to do programs, and watching the ways that the individuals work and talk about sexual assault or domestic violence, it was really empowering for my staff to be able to stand up and say something.
Well, it sounds like it's a great organization, and I think people won't be disappointed if they come to see
it. Yeah, definitely not. Well, we just want to say thank you to our guests today. We've been talking with Carolyn Duvan, one of the directors of this year's production of the Vagina Monologues at ISU, and Olivia Gard, an actor in the play. So it's been such an interesting discussion, and it makes you think about the meaning of Valentine's Day in a whole new way. So thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you both. Enjoy the V-Day weekend.
That was Break the Chain, produced by Eve Ensler. It was produced to raise awareness for V-Day's global campaign, 1 Billion Rising. 1 Billion Rising represents the 1 in 3 women who experience violence against them in their lifetime. And with 7 billion people in the world, 1 in 3 women adds up to more than 1 billion women and girls who endure beatings and rapes around the world. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And this is our Valentine's Day show.
Valentine's Day is celebrated differently in different countries around the world. In the United States, the most common Valentine's Day gifts, as we know, are probably chocolate, candy, and flowers. But there are different views on this holiday, and we're going to hear some different perspectives on these Valentine's Day consumer trends and what we buy. First, Jim Werbel, one of our reporters, interviewed a local florist who tries to meet the high demand consumers have for cut flowers this week.
Good morning, Dan, and thanks for your interview with us. Let's talk about Valentine's Day. This must be a very busy time of year for you.
It is a very busy time. And of course, no matter how much planning you do, you always have the people that come at the very last minute that you are trying to accommodate. But you know this is coming every year, so we plan as far in advance as we can.
What are the most popular Valentine's Day gifts that you sell?
99% of what we'll sell will be fresh flowers. Roses, of course, are popular, but the trend also continues to grow in sending mixed bouquets, so mixed spring flowers and lilies that will last longer for our customers. And some people like just to have the mixed colors instead of always having roses.
Do you ever sell silk flowers at this time of year instead of the real flowers?
Yes, we do have customers that request the permanent botanicals.
Have you seen any changes in customer preferences over the years for Valentine's Day gifts?
There's always changes. When I first started working in the industry in the late 80s, everybody always wanted baby's breath or balloons. And now I've seen the customer grow more sophisticated to where they want things that are more clean lined or sleek and modern, where we've kind of gotten away from have so much extra filler and there's more focus on the blooms.
How much do your sales increase during the week of Valentine's Day versus, say, the first week in March?
All of our volume for Valentine's Day typically goes out in that 2 or 3 day window. So we probably increase our sales, I would say, four to five times than what we would do in a normal week.
This must be a very profitable time of year for you.
That's kind of a false belief that people have about Valentine's Day. Even though we do have increased volume, our expenses are a lot higher than they are the rest of the year in the amount of labor that we have to have and the amount of staff that we have on hand, and all of the wholesale costs that we pay are sometimes double or triple of that they are the rest of the year. So even though we do have a large increase in orders, it's not necessarily as profitable as it would be other times of the year.
So your costs for your flowers really are significantly higher and your profit margins greatly diminish.
Well, the analogy that I like to use for my customers when they ask me about that is that there are only so many rose bushes planted in the world and only so many flowering greenhouses that can grow fresh cut flowers. So when the demand is 10 times higher for flowers at 1 week of the year and there's only so many plants with blooming buds on them, obviously the supplier that grows them gets their bigger piece of the pie.
Then where do you get your flowers at this time of year?
Most of our flowers are imported from Ecuador, South America, the Holland market. We do have some things that are in cut flower production that come out of California, so that would be under glass this time of year. But everything is typically brought into the States from overseas.
When I grew up, I remember roses having fragrance. I wonder if it seems to be a thing of the past. Is this true?
I would say it was a thing of the past a few years ago. However, breeders are really trying to incorporate the scent back into flowers. When they were breeding flowers several years ago, the main intent was to have the buds last long and to have a beautiful petal count. And so many of the consumers complain that the fragrance of days gone by was no longer there in the bud. Since then, they are now trying to breed scent back into flowers. It's, of course, a cost to the breeders to have a flower with a scent, because that just means more insecticides and more pesticides that they have to use to keep their crop protected, because, of course, the fragrance is in the bud to lure insects.
Do you have any customers requesting reduced herbicides and pesticides for the flowers that they purchase?
That is always a concern. We do have customers that ask for those types of products. Unfortunately, those are not available to us from our supplier, especially in the winter months. If we do get those requests in the summer or in the fall, then we are able to source some of our local growers here in the Midwest, especially through our local farmers at farmers markets and CSAs, that we can do local production and try to keep things more organic. However, at this time, though, with most of the flowering crops being produced in greenhouses and such that are so highly populated, and they do have to regulate with pesticides to keep the crop profitable.
Do you have anything else to tell our listening audience about flowers and Valentine's Day?
If you order your flowers from a professional florist, you should expect them to last. But the care doesn't always just end at the flower shop. The thing that I like to remind all of my customers is that you should always fill all of your vases and all of your arrangements that you get all the way to the top with water. Giving them proper care and cutting the stems every other day and giving them fresh water should help your flowers to last.
Thank you for your time, Dan. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks to Jim Werbel and Dan Brabeck for that interview. As you heard, Valentine's Day gifts in the United States are big business. Sales are expected to be $15.7 billion this year, and the average U.S. consumer is expected to spend about $130 on Valentine's Day.
And we've mentioned the most common gifts are flowers, especially roses and chocolate candy. So 37.8% of Americans will buy flowers for Valentine's Day this year, spending a total of $2.1 billion, and Americans will spend another $2 billion on chocolate candy for Valentine's Day.
That's a lot of money that's spent on Valentine's Day in this country, much more per capita than in most other countries in the world. So we wanted to think about the hidden costs and impacts of those gifts, and that's what we're going to be talking about next. Where does all that money go? Who profits? And what are the environmental and other impacts of producing all those roses and other flowers and chocolates for Valentine's Day? To discuss this, we now have with us Brianna Burke, who is an instructor in the English department at ISU and knows a great deal about these issues. Hello, Brianna, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your interest in this subject?
Yeah, so I'm an environmental justice scholar. I think about environmental racism or how we distribute environmental burdens based on race, class, and gender. And I always try and make it relevant to my students' lives. So because I was teaching the spring semester, I wanted to talk about flowers on Valentine's Day.
And so this is a course in the English department.
Yes.
Right? What's the name of the course?
It's called 445. I think the official designation is Literature Crossing Boundaries, but I call it Global Appetites, Transnational Environmental Justice.
Global appetites. That's a great phrase.
Mm-hmm. So what type of things do the students learn in this class?
So we started by talking about petropolitics, oil, and we looked at what's going on in Nigeria with the Ogoni, and then we looked at Ecuador, which exports a lot of oil. Finally, we started talking about North Dakota, and then right as we were talking about North Dakota, the governor released a statement about the Bakken oil pipeline, so we started talking about Iowa. We'll talk about flowers. We talked about uranium. We'll talk about diamonds next week. We move on to pesticides and other products as well, fruit, that sort of thing.
It may sound strange to our listeners that this is an English course.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
Explain that.
Yeah. So I just think that art and literature, particularly literature and film, is a great way to open up these issues because we learn through narrative, we learn through stories, and if we enter other people's lives, it makes these issues more real. They're less scary than if they were straightforward polemics. Teach students to actually care about the people invested in the problem.
Yeah, to recognize the impacts on people. And so do you get a range of student majors taking the course?
In this class, no, because it's a senior seminar in the English department.
Okay.
But when I teach environmental literature, it's part of the environmental studies program, so I get students from all over the campus. And when I teach post-colonial, which we talk a lot about some of these issues in post-colonial as well, I get students from all across campus.
Well, it sounds like a great course. I wish I could take it.
Thank you.
So let's focus a bit more on flowers now.
Sure.
So what can you tell us? We heard some statistics, but what can you tell us about the extent of flower sales and related things at this time of year?
Okay, so I know that we spend about $18 billion on flowers annually, and that's a little bit of an older number. It comes from a report in 2007. But I know last year we spent bought 233 million roses. So we spend a lot of money on it, and 60% of our flowers come from Colombia. So our impact on the people and the environment there is large.
And so there, I'm assuming there's a supply chain between where they're grown in South America and when they end up in either in the supermarket or the florist here.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to us? And
no, I don't actually know much about the supply chain, although I did ask Hy-Vee where the roses came from, and they told me they came from Ecuador and Colombia and that they get them from wholesalers. I also know that there are growers in Florida and California flower associations that have lobbied the government to be less kind to imported flowers, to buy more from California and Florida.
Okay, but most of them come from Ecuador and Colombia.
Yes.
Especially Colombia, you're saying.
Yes.
And through some kind of middle person, and then they end up here in Iowa for us
yeah.
to buy.
Yeah, and we started encouraging Colombia to grow them as an alternative to cocaine.
Interesting, that good old war on drugs.
Yes.
So tell us about some of the environmental or other impacts that growing those flowers have.
Yeah, so roses are an incredibly thirsty crop. I don't know if anybody knows that, but they take up a lot of water. So they're depleting the aquifer beneath Bogota, which is one of the problems. They also require a tremendous amount of pesticides because we know American consumers don't like to buy anything that's blemished, even fruit or vegetables. So there's no, they call it MRLs, no minimum residue limit on flowers, so they can spray as much pesticides as they want. 1/3 of those pesticides are illegal here in the United States. But we're still being exposed to them through residue. The big problem, of course, is the workers being exposed to the pesticides and then the runoff into the water and into the soil.
And I've been to Colombia and been to the area around Bogota, and they grow them up to very high altitudes on the volcanoes outside, and it's just changed huge swaths of the countryside.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about deforestation, but also they're using their most arable land to grow cash crop when they could be growing food to support themselves. So that's also a big issue.
And also impacts the health of the workers.
Yes. Yeah. So 60% of the workforce is women between the ages of 30 and 50. And they're exposed to high levels of pesticides, of course. A lot of them don't have protective gear. A lot of the growers associations don't keep track of the time between spraying pesticides and when they allow their workers back into the greenhouses. We have limits for that in the United States, but they're pretty much disregarded in some countries. So workers are exposed to a high rate of pesticides, which results in asthma, rashes, vision problems, and for women, a higher than average incidence of stillbirth, miscarriage, and birth defects.
And, I heard that some pesticides that are used in growing flowers elsewhere are actually illegal in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. 20% of the pesticides used in Colombia are illegal here.
Is there an alternative? What's the alternative?
Yeah, my students ask me that too. They say, well, if we stop buying these flowers, won't those people not have jobs anymore? It's a good question. You know, we have this cultural value of buying roses on Valentine's Day. I don't really know where that comes from, but I think there are other things we could buy. I mean, first of all, buy domestic if you can buy domestic, or buy from people here who grow it here. That's even better. But I would much rather see that money stay in our own economy instead of buying something perishable, going out to dinner and supporting the people who work here in Ames. Should I also say chocolates are fair trade, and we've done a lot better job with chocolates than we have with flowers, for sure.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. So I was going to ask that if you do go to some stores, even now, you will see flowers with various kinds of fair trade symbols and so on them. Do they really mean anything, or should we be skeptical of those?
Oh, that's always a question, right? Like the organic label. I see them as symbols of people for working equality on the ground. Whether or not they're fully achieving that, they're still working for it. So mm-hmm. I feel like we should support those efforts. But yeah, ask questions, do your research before you buy.
And then going back to chocolate, as yeah. we started already. So where do those ingredients grow, and like what are the problems that are connected to their cultivation?
Yeah, I don't know everything that goes into chocolate, but I can talk about palm oil and cocoa.
Okay.
So cocoa is cultivated mostly in tropical regions, and I know they're having a huge problem with child slavery, particularly in Western Africa, where a lot of cocoa is grown, particularly in Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast. There's some incidents of it in Ghana as well. And I know that Ghana exports, 64% of its exports are chocolate. You know, they have a problem with that there. Palm oil is a whole different issue because palm oil grows in rainforests, and palm oil cultivation has contributed to deforestation, but it's also severely cut back habitat for primates and large mammals. And so that's a huge issue.
So like what other environmental impacts are there for this type of cultivation?
For coca or for?
For both.
Palm oil. Well, palm oil became a cash crop. It wasn't for a long time. And I know that there's a lot of pressure to force companies to stop using it. So I don't know if anybody's familiar with the Kit Kat palm oil campaign, but this palm oil, anti-palm oil organization made a commercial where a guy unwrapped a Kit Kat and there was a gorilla finger in it. And it really pressured Nestle. They no longer use palm oil in their chocolates, so it actually worked. But, you know, PepsiCo, Kraft Foods, Burger King, they are all still using palm oil.
So do you think that consumer habits can bring about significant change? I mean, when we heard from the florist, he talked about how preferences for scented flowers have resulted in some change, actually a negative an environmental impact. But, you know, it speaks to the idea that how much weight can consumer choices and buying certain things and not buying other things have? Or is the system just so big that consumer preference can't really change it? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we talk about that a lot in my class. I think change has to start personally. So can we change the entire system? No, but we can definitely influence it. If there's not a demand for a product, they'll stop growing it because it's all about profit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we can vote with our dollar. This is something Martin Luther King started talking about in the 60s. So I really believe that's true. I don't know that we can necessarily change the system, but we can force companies to make better choices. And that's really about knowing the impact of the products you buy. That supply chain is so long, and it's long on purpose to hide mm-hmm. these effects from consumers, because I really do believe if we knew the full impact, we would make different choices.
And I think people obviously think about it impacts them. And when you talked about the pesticides, I think people don't realize that when they buy roses, they may be impacted by the pesticides as well. They can be still have residues. And
yeah.
So, you know, they say that you should actually wash your hands after you handle, you know, you put your roses in a vase or something. And, you know, maybe that's a way to get people to realize that it's actually having negative impacts on them. And maybe that's easier for people to understand than far away impacts, which are important as well.
Yeah, it's easier to invest in the personal.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't understand that when the roses are sent to us, they're sent to us as buds, right? Because they want them to be in full bloom when they're on your kitchen table. So inside those roses, that the pesticide lives there. And as it opens up, right, it's greater exposure.
Mm-hmm. So do you think some of the habits of students in your class were changed for this Valentine's Day?
I don't know. I'll have to ask them on Tuesday whether or not they purchased roses. I have a number of students who work at Hy-Vee, and so I was talking to them about the flowers there. I know that they struggle to change their personal choices. And one of the things I tell them is that, you know, you can't overhaul your entire life immediately, but you can start educating yourself on particular choices and change them gradually. And that change is sustainable over time, as opposed to, you know, you immediately overwrite it.
And I know you can buy fair trade chocolate bars
yes.
in a number of places, even in the regular like supermarkets like Hy-Vee now.
Yeah.
But I haven't, to be honest, I haven't gone looking at Valentine's Day chocolate heart kinds of candies. But is there fair trade Valentine candy specifically available?
I'm sure there is. I mean, I had a student last year who put stickers all over the carts on Hy-Vee saying, don't buy palm oil chocolate, save the gorilla, which I thought was pretty funny, her activism, you know, wandering through the aisles of Hy-Vee. I know Wheatsfield sells sustainable chocolate, sustainably harvested chocolate. Both flowers and chocolate can be sustainably grown, right? They don't have to be environmentally exploitative.
Well, you've given us lots to think about, and I know I'll consider those things when I think about Valentine's Day this
Same.
Year. Yeah, so you've definitely impacted my awareness. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Brianna Burke, an instructor in the English department at ISU, where she teaches a very interesting course called Global Appetites, Transnational Environmental Justice.
And because it's Friday, we now have our weekly listing of musical happenings for the weekend.
This is Belinda Merritt with the live music for February 13th through the 19th. On Friday, February 13th, Richard Arndt will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler, from 9 o'clock p.m. until 12 o'clock a.m. Bonnie Finken and The Collective will be at the maintenance shop in ISU's Memorial Union at 9 o'clock p.m. Josh Davies will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, the Marshall J Band will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler, at 9 o'clock p.m. That One Guy will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Tuesday, February 17th, Fat Tuesday, Megan Jean and the KFB will be at Blue Stem, which is the former Zeke's, 3329 Lincoln Way, at 8 o'clock p.m. Thank you.
That's it. Thanks to Belinda Merritt for that. It sounds like there are some good opportunities to hear music on this Valentine's Day weekend.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We would like to thank Olivia Gard and Carolyn Duven, who are an actor and a director of the play The Vagina Monologues, which you can see tonight at 6 and 9 in the Union at ISU. Thank you as well to Brianna Burke, an instructor at ISU, and to Dan Brabeck, a local florist, for their perspectives on consumer demand for flowers and chocolate candy for Valentine's Day.
Local Talk was engineered by Rebecca Brown. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Break the Chain, produced by Eve Ensler. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible.
Your hosts for Local Talk today were Gail Seiler and Jasmine Mergia, an intern at KHOI this semester and a journalism major at ISU. Remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of KHOI. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.